Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, Tulsa Mayor Dewey Bartlett announced voluntary water restrictions based on yesterday's water usage here in the city of 207 million gallons. That follows Sunday's usage of 197 million gallons, which triggers voluntary water restrictions. In fact, if usage continues at the same rate today as yesterday, we'll be looking at mandatory water restrictions tomorrow. Today on Studio Tulsa, we'll hear why the water restrictions are necessary from City Water Supply Manager Bob Brownwood, then how to make the most of the water we do use for our lawns, trees, and shrubs from horticulturist Barry Fugit. But first, I spoke earlier today with Bob Brownwood, the water supply manager for the City of Tulsa, about the usage, about the restrictions, and why those figures of 197 million and 207 million gallons trigger restrictions. Bob Brownwood, thanks for taking time out of your day to talk with us this morning, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, the big news everybody wants to know, did we hit 197 million gallons on Monday?
Actually, we hit 207 million gallons.
And that's really bad in two ways, isn't it?
Well, it puts us closer to mandatory restrictions, correct.
So with that usage yesterday, we're now under voluntary water restrictions. I know we call it voluntary water rationing, but really we're just asking people to hold off on watering. Now, how does this work?
Exactly. Well, the mayor will probably make an announcement soon asking people to cut back on their usage so that we can make sure we don't run out of water in the future.
And what's involved with the restrictions? Is it every other day watering?
Yes, it's watering from midnight to noon, and eventually it'll be odd even homes. And
so today being the 31st, it would be an odd day.
Yes.
And then tomorrow the 1st would also
be an odd day.
Even lose out.
That's right.
So the even odd water today while the voluntary restrictions are out there.
Yeah. Well, no, don't do that. We're trying to stop watering. Typically, what happened last year is when we asked for a voluntary curtailment, we actually saw an increase in usage. So
really?
People going out and getting their one last water in before it went to mandatory, I guess.
Yeah, and once we get to mandatory, if we have the same usage today as we did yesterday, then we're looking at a mandatory ration.
Yeah, that would be correct.
And that would be the odd-even system where, based on the last number of your address and the date, if it's the first, people with odd number of addresses would water. And again, the restrictions are midnight to noon, correct?
Correct.
Now, the figure of 197 million gallons, 207 million gallons, what are those numbers based on in the system? Is that about as much water as we can carry a day into the system?
Well, in terms of water treatment and delivery and capacity and what have you, there's multiple ways we look at that. One is our raw water capacity, how much water we can bring into the city's two treatment plants. And then the next phase would be how much the treatment plants can treat. And then the final capacity issue is how much the treatment plants can deliver into the system, into the distribution system pipes, into the city and the tanks and what have you. All those three components have limiting factors. As far as raw water supply, it's more a sustained usage. So we have two treatment plants. Jewel plant can deliver 115 million gallons of water from the Lake Ulaga to the plant. And then Mohawk plant, we can deliver about 95 million gallons of water from the reservoirs to the plant. And each plant, Jewel and Mohawk, have their respective terminal reservoirs, which hold about 1.5 billion gallons of water. So we utilize what we can deliver to the plants, those terminal reservoirs, and that gives us a sustained capability.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Mohawk plant has a treatment capacity of 100 million gallons of water a day, and the Jewel plant has a treatment capacity of around 120 million gallons a day. So we can deliver about 95 million gallons a day to Mohawk, and it can treat 100 million gallons a day. So the longer we do that, the lower the
Lake Yohola starts going.
Exactly.
Going down.
So if the heat and drought last a week, we're not concerned. When it lasts from June to August, that's when we start getting concerned. Lynn Lane, very similar. We can deliver almost as much as Jewel can treat, so same scenario there. As far as treatment capacity, the treatment capacity is kind of a max day capacity. When we have to treat full capacity day in, day out for weeks on end, eventually we have to backwash filters, we have to clean equipment, clean basins, sedimentation basins, which is part of the process. All that takes processed water away from what we can deliver to the city. So the longer we have to sustain that high production, the more the plants are taxed, and pretty soon we need to take a breather so that we can start cleaning up the process of producing water.
So we're really, it sounds like from what you're saying, we're in no danger of turning on a tap and, you know, maybe a drip coming out or anything like that. We're in good shape that way. It's a matter of just wear and tear on the equipment, which if you had one of the plants go down, that would cause a problem.
Definitely, definitely. And then as far as the final capacity issue is delivering the water that we've treated into the city. And that's kind of where we start hitting the issue. Jewel can deliver about 110 million gallons a day, and Mohawk can deliver 100 million gallons a day. Now, there's slight variations to that. Mohawk can sometimes deliver 110. Jewel can sometimes deliver 115. But when you put the two plants together, pumping water into the same system, they kind of hydraulically fight with each other. And so the combined capacity of the system is 210 million gallons a day, what we can deliver. We have about 100 million gallons of storage in tanks in the system, and then the piping itself will hold about 150 million gallons of water. So when we talk about sustaining capacity issues, and where we get concerned with is if people are using, say, 210 million gallons of water a day, that's on average.
You're going to see a slow drop in water pressure.
Right. Our plants are producing the maximum they can produce, and then anything that we go over or under, the tanks carry that. So when we say 210 million gallons a day, that's on an average. But in the morning, we may be using 280 million gallons a day for 3 or 4 hours. And then in the evening, we're using maybe 250 million gallons a day for 2 hours. So at that time, the tanks are supplying all the excess water that the plants can't. So then we have to catch up at night to try and replenish the tanks. And that's where we are monitoring that continuously.
Now, how long has it been since we upgraded our capacity? I mean, Tulsa's had pretty stable population, although we've had growth in the suburbs over the last couple of decades. But, you know, I think the last census figure I saw, we're poised to pass 400,000 people in the city, within the city itself. Have we upgraded our water combined with, you know, all the growth of the suburbs as far as the water capacity?
The plants have had excess capacity for years.
Mm-hmm.
And again, last summer and this summer being exceptionally hot, as we know, last July was the hottest month in the nation for any state on record. And then this summer seems to be about the same. Those are exceptions. Mm-hmm. And you try and plan for the exceptions, but you don't build capacity for those exceptions, or you can, but that's
sort of wasted, yeah.
Right. So the plants have been more than sufficient capacity until these last two summers when it's been exceptionally high and dry. And so there is in process the plan on upgrading the Jewel plants 10 million gallons a day. Hopefully we're going to start that process next fall. The thing we got to remember and everyone needs to take in mind is
this only happens for a couple months a year.
Well, this only happens for a couple months, but we can only do construction work on the plants in the fall because we need the capacity in the summer. So if we're going to plan anything, it has to be in the fall for construction unless we have a completely new phase where it doesn't impact operations at all, which is rare. So next fall, we're hoping to be in starting the construction of upgrading Jewel by 10 million gallons a day. And then we do have plans 2014. I think we're looking at another upgrade. And then 2019, another upgrade.
So definitely the water department is looking at future usage.
Yeah, the water department develops a 10-year plan every 10 years. And we're just in the process of updating that plan actually right now.
All right. So for now, it is voluntary water restrictions. The city is hoping that residents will today, odd-numbered addresses, water. Tomorrow, again, odd-number addresses. And then the evens finally get their opportunity on the 2nd. And hopefully we won't hit 207 million gallons, which will mean mandatory rationing. And at that point, you know, do you foresee a time when there'll be, you know, citations for people ignoring the mandatory rationing, or is that not your purview?
hopefully I don't see that time, and that people will make the decision to help themselves out and the community out. But we would be prepared for that if we get to this phase where, you know, water usage continues to climb and people don't listen to our plea to stop using water or directive, and then, yeah, we would look at issuing citations.
All right. Well, let's hope it doesn't get to that point, and hopefully people will follow the restrictions as they exist today. Bob Brownwood, thanks very much for your time.
All right. Thank you, Rich.
Bob Brownwood is the water supply manager for the City of Tulsa, speaking with us earlier today here on Studio Tulsa. Mayor Dewey Bartlett announced voluntary water restrictions based on yesterday's water usage of 207 million gallons. In fact, if we have that same amount of usage today, we'll be looking at mandatory water restrictions. But for now, voluntary restrictions. Voluntary restrictions involve watering from midnight to noon every other day based on even and odd dates and home addresses. For example, today and tomorrow are watering days for odd number addresses. All right, well, restrictions are in place. Most of that water is being used for plant life to save our yards. We're now joined by Barry Fugit, Director of Horticulture for the Tulsa Garden Center and the Linnaeus Teaching Garden, who joins us with tips on how to protect the trees, shrubs, and gardens around our houses from this second consecutive year of drought and high temperatures. Barry Fugit, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
This is a challenging time for a gardener with 105, 110 degree temperatures at this time of year. And this is our second summer in a row. What is this doing for plant life in Tulsa? It can't be good.
Well, it's certainly separating the species that are better favored to live here than from those that are not. And we're certainly seeing that. And you've hit on something that's very correct, and that is that putting these back-to-back is no good thing. So we had the damage of last year, which all of us were hoping that was a one-shot deal and we'd go back to normal. But having this 2 years in a row is affecting plants and very drastically.
What's affecting the plant life in the city more, the drought or the heat?
You can't separate them. Drought and heat are twin towers in botanical features. They're both, a plant is genetically predisposed to live within a certain range in terms of its water requirements and a certain range within its temperature requirement. It's genetically set so that it won't go below a certain point, and it doesn't want to go or won't go above a certain point. So having these spikes 2 years in a row above the temperature spike that a lot of species are able to tolerate is doing some damage throughout the system.
Now, before we actually talk about techniques to help get your trees and shrubs and the like through this summer, the growers, what they're sending to our area for sale, are they designed for this sort of heat and this sort of low humidity? I mean, yesterday at the height of the day, we were down to like Phoenix humidity. Mm-hmm. It was like 17%.
I couldn't believe it, yeah. And are nursery stocked with all material that is ideally predisposed to do well here? No. But I think the nurseryman in general, the vast majority of what they sell, if we take care of it properly, can survive here okay. And another concern, you know, is our native plant material. Again, as I drove down Riverside Drive this morning, glanced over at Turkey Mountain, that's all native material that covers that mountain there or that high hill. But you can see the tops of those black oaks and red oaks all through there that are beginning to discolor. So even native material that is used to many, many decades, centuries of a certain level of weather conditions, when that begins to change, plants are very sensitive. They pick up on that and can be damaged seriously by it.
Now, when you see the tops of the trees turning yellow or sort of losing their color, a lot of times that's just the tree's defense mechanism, isn't it?
It's a good point, yeah. It is, but it's telling you that I'm going into the survival mode, and I can only stay there for a certain period of time. And so what we're all praying for is that the stress is on out there. Plants have different capacities to deal with various kinds of stresses, temperature stress, moisture stress, but it's reached the point where many, many species are showing that I am in deep distress, and that it really does have to change. Whether that's another week, 2 weeks, it depends on growing conditions at that particular site.
Now, you know, most Tulsans don't live in multi-unit housing. We have yards, we have trees, we have shrubs because we're single-family homes. Right. So what's the best way to keep everything functioning until maybe the rains come in the fall?
Well, the thing that I'm encouraging people to do, you know, with the city looking at the amount of water we're using, and that looks like that's going to get very serious for us because I don't see any rain coming, according to the weather guys, for the next week or so. What we can do is to start thinking about the plant material that's in our yard, which are the ones that I can pay less attention to, and which ones do I need to start getting up. Like you were telling me, your wife gets up very early in the morning. I was up before daylight this morning watering as well, but prioritizing. And there are valuable shrubs in my yard. There are some valuable ornamental trees. I just don't want to lose those guys, you know. But my lawn, the backyard, I have not watered at one time this summer yet.
It's brown and crackly.
You could drop a kid's stroller into one of those cracks in my backyard. But in other words, I'm not going to worry about the lawn. Aesthetically, we'd all love to have lush green lawns, but that's where a lion's share of this water is going, is to keep that Bermuda grass green out there. And the good news there is that we can let that Bermuda grass go into a deep yellow state, and in most instances, after we've had a rain or two, it'll come roaring back. So I'm going to put less of my gallons of water there and concentrate more on some of the trees and some of the shrubs, the azaleas in my yard, and keep those going.
Now, let's talk about with water restrictions, you know, in the extreme, we're not there yet, but, you know, when rationing takes place, you're looking at every other day and perhaps restrictions on when you can do it. What are some strategies to save water but be effective in taking care of your plants?
Well, since I was a young kid in horticulture, the professors rightly have always taught that infrequently and in depth when talking about watering, that an infrequent but deep watering of the root system is technically better for the plant, for most species of plants, than that shallow watering every day anyway. So we can survive. We can live with every other day watering should it come to that.
I tell you, I was looking around our yard sometimes, and it's like we water in the morning, a good soaking in the morning, and by you come home in the afternoon, and it looks like everything's wilting.
Well, that's true, and it's going to vary from species to species. But here's another thing to keep in mind. You'll take an example of what you're just talking about would be the big leaf hydrangeas.
Yeah.
Okay, when the temperature is up over 100 degrees and there's plenty of moisture around that root system, those big leaf hydrangeas are going to wilt. And what our listeners might keep in mind is that we perspire. Plants transpire. So they have to suck water into their root system. It's translocated through the plant, then it goes up through the leaves, and there's little pores all in those leaves. So that's how they cool themselves. That's how they suck in nutrients and what have you. So when the conditions are as dry as you mentioned a minute ago, down to 15-20% humidity, and it's 100 degrees, a lot of plants will wilt. So that's not necessarily a sign that the soil doesn't have adequate moisture. It means that I can't pick it up fast enough under these conditions to keep my leaves very crisp, so I'll flag or wilt. But there's no better way than just to get down there and scratch around underneath that mulch and see if, in fact, every other day watering is going to meet the needs.
And you mentioned mulching.
Yeah.
That's key at this particular time of year?
It's absolutely, because, it's temperature and moisture. And the one thing that a blanket of mulch does is keep the soil anywhere from 10 to 25 degrees cooler beneath that mulch than above it. So that's very important to plants.
How much stress is our plant life under? We've had two unusual years. One, an incredibly hard winter, a very hard summer with little moisture. Fall and winter last year that was moderate in temperature, but not a lot of moisture again. And now the second hard summer with very little moisture.
Well, again, it's taking its toll. I have to feel for the in the evening news, looking at the farmers and what have you out there. I mean, that must be just a hopeless and desperate situation to see corn and soybeans and the various crops that are just, and those are tough crops. But at some point, every plant has that genetic set point that I just cannot go beyond unless you can give me some sort of artificial watering program. But again, we just can't stress too much that it's heat and water in combination. Once it gets to this depth, that some severe damage. And the first thing that happens, this might be a good mental picture for our listeners. Plants, you have the main roots coming out of a tree or a shrub. Those immediately break into what we call secondary roots and then tertiary roots or third branching roots. And then finally, these little hair roots. So here's what's going on with plants that gardeners might want to keep in mind. It's those very highly absorbing hair roots that some of them are single cell. They're literally like a strand of a human hair. They're that fine. When we get into these kind of conditions, those are the first to die or desiccate. So the plant loses those. Doesn't mean the plant's going to die, but it's lost some of my main absorbing tissue.
And that's the where a lot of the water moisture comes into the tree, right?
Exactly. That's the primary. That's the first avenue into a pipeline that's going to lead up into that tree or into that shrub. So even if when we get over this, the plants are going to have to refurbish their hair root system. That takes energy. So why do droughts weaken plants so much? Because we're losing part of that. Even if my plant survives, I've lost some very important below ground level tissue. I've got to use a lot of energy to regrow all that tissue. And what happens then is we begin to, a plant can be, again, depending on the species, but it can be such in a weakened state that it becomes more vulnerable to all kind of fungi in the soil, Pythiums, Rhizoctonia, all those bad guys that can then weak on a weakened plant further rot the system. So there's long-term consequences to these series of yearly annual droughts.
Yeah, is the risk on that more like things in the ground or is it bugs and pests?
Well, it all goes together, but what we see is, and I wish there were more studies done on this, but just observationally, I see a higher incident of, and I could name all kind of horrible diseases that rot the root systems of even native trees, Ganoderma on lots of them, where you'll see mushrooms, and I don't want to panic our listeners. If you see mushrooms growing this fall, doesn't mean that that's the fruiting body of a fungus that's killing your tree. But in fact, I do tend to see more of the mushrooms popping to the surface on certain species of fungi that are attacking a weakened tree. So that is something to be concerned about. It's another reason that on those valuable plants that we mentioned a minute ago, I'm going to prioritize. What are the most valuable plants in my landscape? Those on every other day watering, I may want to make sure that they don't go into such a stress position that it's going to be hard for them to recover over the next 2 or 3 years. And this is a long-term process sometimes.
You know, this is the second summer in a row, and, you know, we're only midway through. You know, August is usually one of the hottest mm-hmm. months of the year. So, I mean, we could be looking at a long, long, hot summer. Is this going to change what we eventually grow? I mean, at some point, if this is a trend more than just sort of 2 years oddly in a row that's really, really odd.
Well, I'm an educator. So one of the things in answering that question, I would say that it makes all attending classes, attending seminars, and learning about the toughest and best adapted plant material becomes increasingly important. You know, that's the nature of us gardeners. All of us want to grow the latest and to grow odd things, and that's just the fun part of gardening. But I think if this trend continues that you're just talking about, if we're into some sort of a decade-long series where the temperatures are going to be hotter than normal and all of that, boy, it just adds to the importance of before you go and invest $500, $1,000, which is certainly not uncommon in the spring of the year on our yards and gardens, to arm yourself with information about what is the best and the toughest for your region, and then maybe put less dollars into the exotic stuff that just might be fun to watch for a while.
Mm. People, when we have two summers like this, people start thinking about climate change. I think you have to go back to the 1930s where we had 4 or 5 years of this and nobody was talking about climate change then. Right. It could be a sign of climate change. It probably is more likely, you know, a combination of maybe long-term climate change and seasonal observances like we had in the 1930s where you had, mm-hmm. I think it was like 3 or 4 summers where it was just incredibly hot.
Yeah.
And of course, the land was moving at that particular point. If that is the case, what are some of the things we need to keep in mind? That going back to basic
plant selection?
Plant selection.
Sure.
Give us those things that we need to keep in mind.
Well, the first thing I would suggest to gardeners is look around. Look at the hills and the valleys and the plains around Tulsa. We're living on the cusp, right on the western edge of the Great Eastern Forest. So from the Atlantic coast across the Mississippi into Oklahoma, eastern Oklahoma, you see all the big deciduous trees, the oaks, the ash, the hickories, the maples, and what have you, depending upon the site they're growing on. If you put my thumb in a vise and you just said, what is the toughest genus of trees? Now, there's many species within each genus, but what is the toughest genus? You know, I'd have to say oak. And by the way, I'll give a little tip here. We grow, or Mother Nature grows a tree in eastern Oklahoma in the Ozark Plateau, Missouri, and Arkansas called a nuttall, N-U-T-T-A-L, nuttall oak. There is one coming out. I look forward to writing about it this fall. It's called Charisma. It's one of the prettiest oaks. So its parents are native to this part of the country, which isn't going to necessarily mean that it automatically survives. Care is very important during that establishment period. But this new nut all oak that'll be out this fall, if I had a pencil handy, I'm going to plant two in my yard. I am so impressed with them.
When I think of the oaks in the Ozark Plateau, I think of these sort of scrubby, like blackjack oaks.
Blackjack and post oak and those kind of things. But if you go a little bit further east and north, you do get into the big black oaks and the hybridization. There's many crosses there. But those big, gigantic oaks that can live 300, 400, 500 years. So in terms of plant material selection, when we start with trees, I would certainly look at the oak family probably first. And there's many, many to choose from. But I think that charisma is just going to be beautiful. By the way, Rich, it comes out with a lavender color foliage in the spring of the year. And then when it gets this hot, it goes back to green. And then in the fall of the year, it turns bright red. So, I mean, that's a killer. So, but anyway, I'd look at the oak species. I see a lot of people planting maples up on high areas in South Tulsa or West Tulsa. That's probably not the best idea. They do better on lower sites, riverbank areas, and just floodplain areas rather. But I would sure stick with some of the native plant material. But I wouldn't just. I'm not a nativist in the sense that I think we should only plant native plant material. I don't buy that. But it's certainly good to look at that. I have two children that are starting homes and what have you. And that would be my suggestion to them. Do you need two or three trees on this property for shading and in framing that home? Let's look at the oaks first, and there's a lot to choose from there. And then let's look at some of the more exotic species. But, gosh, Rich, if we had a dollar for every time someone plants a dogwood, for instance, out in the middle of a sunny yard in the Broken Arrow area in clay soil, it has almost no chance of surviving. And they've spent $50 or $250 on some of these trees. Just crazy stuff, but...
All right. Well, last word on if we have water restrictions coming down the road, what are some of the things we need to keep in mind to make sure that you mentioned prioritizing what you water and what about the best watering techniques, soaker hoses or, you know, hand watering or letting the sprinklers run?
Any way that you can do it that allows the water to enter slowly is what you want to do. Just coming to the studio, looking at the drip irrigation that's installed around the trees here on TU's campus, the use of gator bags, by the way, you see that as a wonderful new trend. It's these big bags that you put around the trunk of a tree, you fill them up, and they very slowly release. That's critical on newly planted to 2 or 3 year old plants, trees in your yard. But a mistake I see is people applying water so fast, you're getting a lot of runoff. And as the soil gets dry, it doesn't want to initially absorb that water. It just wants to bead and run off. So applying it slowly, and that's drip irrigation, that soaker hoses that you mentioned, or it's, you know, what I'll do is I'll water a plant, and then I'll go on down the line, water two or three others, and then come back and water that first one again. Give that first watering a chance to soak in a little bit. Then the second watering, I'll get some depth to it.
All right. Barry Fugit, always great to have your advice on ways to take care of our Oklahoma plants in this very hot summer. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Barry Fugit is the Director of Horticulture at the Tulsa Garden Center and the Linnaeus Teaching Garden, speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent broadcasts, you can listen anytime on our website at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.